our friend, writer Colin Fleming, author of the wonderful new book, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a short satirical story of the last bro, available wherever fine books are sold. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Rich?
I am getting ready for some snow. I guess it's time. It's December. I should expect that kind of thing.
I hear that they also call you the cold miser, because you were the one who did that dance first. They took that from you. You get royalties. Every time I watch that, I think, oh, Kimball, cha-ching, this man, he's just rolling in it. Lucky guy.
It's funny you say that, because as a kid, I would copy that move. I had it down pat pretty well. I might think today I would hurt myself trying it, but
I always think of you, and I don't mean to like put you down with this, but I always think of you as like when he comes out the little versions of himself, and they're spinning around, and they have the top hat.
Mm.
He has the whole ensemble. I always think of those as like little Kimballs.
I like that. That strangely enough warms my heart, Colin.
There you go, man.
We want to talk about a number of things this week. I was starting with a new piece in Jazz Times about the great Art Tatum and his recordings on what are known as V-discs. Can you explain what they are?
Sure. V-discs are awesome. And a lot of the art that we have in the world of any kind, Shakespeare even, we owe to pirates and bootleggers. And so in the mid-1940s, there was a recording label that was set up where it wasn't just jazz musicians. You could be a Broadway musician. You could be a number of classical musicians even. And you would record whatever it could be something that you didn't normally record. There was a recording band, so you weren't going into the studio to cut records for the public. But you could make records for the GIs overseas. And it was illegal for these records to come back into the States. So you were supposed to destroy them if you were a GI or whatever that might have been. But it was music made exclusively for these people in this singular greatest generation situation. And some of these artists really cut loose in ways that they might not have otherwise. I think it meant different things, different people. But like, for instance, Count Basie has these recordings with Lester Young, and Lester Young, like you would with Air Shots, which were remote recordings from like a club that you'd listen to at your home. So it's a way to hear a live recording without buying a live album. Lester Young would play solos that he ordinarily wouldn't play in the studio. And Art Tatum did a lot of solo piano recordings. They weren't all solo piano recordings for the troops that comprised some of the best music that this singular, unclassifiable pianist ever made.
Yeah, and as you point out, while nobody mailed it in, few people did their best work on these V discs. What is it about these performances that make them stand out from your perspective?
I think he was touched by what these people were doing in terms of service, and he wanted to repay that in a way that would show his affection, really, for these people that he hadn't met and what they were doing. I think part of that too was, as an African-American at that time in this country, there was that extra element of doing something for others and for freedom, and freedom that one had and freedom that one wished to have that should have been possessed but really wasn't in some ways. So Tatum was always a strange cat, though, when it came to putting him in the best setting. Later in the 1950s, an attempt would be made by Norman Granz to pair Tatum with these Buddy Rich, which you wouldn't really think that Art Tatum would go with Buddy Rich. Different groups, and also just record him on his own, because he was a jazz musician who was also this Glenn Gould-type improviser. Not that Gould improvised, but he had that level of chops, level of technique at the piano. So you couldn't really put Art Tatum into any category, but he was put into this setting, and it was one that he responded well to.
And you explain in your piece in Jazz Times that his introduction to some of the performances also adds another level of intimacy and poignancy to them.
Sure, it's touching, and you don't get to hear these musicians talk that much. Now, you get to hear Art Blakey or somebody like that if they're at a club and it's live recording and they're serving almost as de facto MC. But Tatum is largely voiceless to us. So to hear him very intimately wishing these men well, and then playing a song, you can feel him trying to please them. Whatever you were doing that was life-altering, even as this continued on after the actual war itself, after D-Day. But even still, you're cleaning up a region, a country, a culture, and all of that responsibility. And I think he really rose to that level of societal compunction. I think it was clearly important to him. And the records, fortunately, they made it back. Someone actually did go to jail for a lengthy amount of time. It's really a true story that, like, you could get hunted down for this. But things being what they are, these recordings found a way to survive, and now you can listen to them on YouTube or download the MP3 version for like $6.99.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Check out Colin's piece on Art Tatum in Jazz Times, jazztimes.com. Let's move from there to a wonderful radio play from a series that we've talked about on more than one occasion, The Great Quiet Please, in an episode entitled Berlin 1945.
Well, listeners, as you know, Rich and I stay up deep into the night finding ways that we can come up with clever segues into the various components that we talk about on the show. So I like to imagine in this radio play that these soldiers are, because they could have been, right, that they might have listened to Art Tatum's V-Discs recordings that day, and they're in bombed-out Berlin, and they're having this makeshift Christmas meal, and the squadron, there's not a lot of the men left. They started out with this many, and now it's just a handful of them. And they're breaking bread in this very low-key, bombed-out sort of setting. And someone's at the door, essentially, and they end up inviting this guy in. It takes a while for them to get there. They all tell their story. And don't you think it's fascinating? It's so believable. It's like you're just listening back in time to real-life people. You'd never think it was a radio play. Even if you go in listening to it as a radio play, at some moment, that awareness departs from you. And it's just like, oh, wow, I'm in the time machine, and I'm really with these people. You want to speak up and say, oh, well, from there, they're having these very specific memories of where they came from.
Mm.
And someone shows up, and finally, it's the great actor we've talked about, Ernest Chappell. And he is this displaced figure. He actually uses the word displaced, and he sits down, and they're starting to think, I know you from somewhere. They're all trying to figure out where he's from in Chappell. He lets the conversation come to him. He's great. He's like, I was there.
Yeah, I love it when they say, well, you speak very good English. He's like, well, I speak several languages.
Yeah, it's almost like a little bit of a play on Sympathy for the Devil, right? But the reverse, with Mick Jagger and of speaking in all these different tongues and all these languages. And of course, that comes from Bulgakov's Master and Margarita. But the idea that I can speak any language because I speak the language of the heart and of the soul. And he's very much this, like he says, the displaced figure. And you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to put together that he's probably more than just some guy who wandered in. But he plays the part of a guy who wanders in. He gives of his time to these men. He does really something quite similar to what Art Tatum does. And I think it's a bit on the nose at the end, and it doesn't have to be. They could have left it more open-ended. And normally Willis Cooper, the showrunner, as it were, for Quiet Time, would have done that. But the point has already been made by then.
Yeah, it's great, though. I listened to it late last night, and apparently it was so good. The version I listened to, they had replayed from the previous Christmas because it was so popular.
Yes, that's the surviving version. And listeners who've heard us talk about Quiet Please before know that it wasn't on that long. It was just a couple of years. But what I really like about this, too, is this one surviving recording is from the day after Christmas. And I love that. I like things that happen after Christmas. Like a lot of the action, in a way, the real-life action of A Christmas Carol takes place after Christmas. Right. It's just
right.
He's getting up and he's going around and he goes to see nephew Fred and all of that, because you don't just want it to be like, OK, this is the day. Let's be up nice up until the day and then we'll all just be rubbish to each other again. You have to carry that forward. And I like that this aired on Boxing Day.
Well, let's go from that to a carol that has been around since at least the 17th century, I saw three ships.
Underrated, Carol. And I think it's partially underrated because it baffles people in a way. Because I like, as you know, and we were talking about a recent radio program that was from 1933, I like Christmas at Sea, in a way, I guess you could say. I like the nautical element of sea. And if you watch 1951 Scrooge, which I'm doing a book on right now, there's this sequence in the Christmas past where Scrooge and the ghost, they sail in the air over these aqueous scenes, and it's very powerful. And so that's how I've always thought about this. I like sea by the Christmas by the coast. And people have wondered what the three ships actually refer to. A popular theory is that they're the three camels that the wise men rode on the so-called ships of the desert. But I don't know. I like sort of the transitive property of the three ships, that it's more about that number and then it is about something like, oh, there are three schooners on the horizon. But I also like that component too, because I'm a man of the sea, and I like that. I like going down to the harbor. I'm alone at Christmas and thinking about, okay, where are you going to be next year? Let's keep trying. And something about the sea and even just looking out over it that I don't know, I've always loved this carol.
Well, and it may also relate to the carol we discussed last week, that there are those who think this might have to do with the journeys of our good King Wenceslas from last week.
Yes, it could be a King Wenceslas kind of thing, because it there's a kind of visual riff, or what Picasso would call a rhyme, with his coat of arms. And I like the whole osmosis thing, all this pooling of these Christmas traditions. And you have a minor key. It's what's so great about Christmas carols. They're almost always in a minor key, but they don't bring you down. And I think that endues them with a life quality, because I see people, these just vapid fools on dating sites, life is meant to be fun. I'm always like, no, it's not. It's not meant to be fun. It's meant to spur you to grow, to develop, and for richness and awareness and epiphany and helping other people. And yes, there can be a component of fun to that. So that's, to me, the way life is supposed to be, where it's in a minor key, but it's also not a dirge. And I think these Christmas carols, these best Christmas carols like this one, I saw three ships, represent that idea.
All right, and finally, we want to talk about a couple of terrific Christmas episodes of two great TV series, and both occurred in their first seasons. Let's start with Newhart from season one and their episode, No Room at the Inn, Snowstorm, and Special Guests Arriving at the Stratford Inn.
These two shows, Newhart and Frasier, they changed so much. And really, Newhart is only Newhart as I think of it in the first season. It's quirky Americana. After that, it really becomes something else. It becomes broad. It becomes a kind of surrealism. Bob Newhart himself, who is this kind of dumbfounded person bearing witness in the first season, becomes caustic, even becomes cruel, and I'm less keen on that. But he certainly isn't in this first season, where you have that vintage, quirky Americana that you get in some certain remote portions of New England, probably Maine, right? Vermont, parts of New Hampshire, and characters. And I don't think like the Three Woodsmen of Newhart were really that far afield from some of the people that you could and probably still can encounter. So they're at the inn, and of course they have an inn. And if you're a writer for a show like that, you're probably going to do some sort of variation on a pregnant person showing up. And it's funny because they have these guests that are just hopping mad, right? It's funny how angry they are that it's snowing outside so badly that they can't ski. And they take out that it's rage really on Newhart, like blaming him for the weather. And it turns out when this person that they do make room for, even though there is no room at the inn because of her situation, her family situation, that all of these people who were there grumbling about their inability to take the slopes, they're doctors. So they can't wait to raise up the stairs, this ski club of doctors, to have something to do. Like, they're all hovering around and like acting as like human stirrups, I guess. But it's touching. And when it is on the nose at the end, when like, it's like this guy shows up,
like, what's his friend? Like, I'm Alan Weissman. It's like Weissman. Ah, Newhart. You're so funny. And because by then you're in on the joke and you're expecting that to happen. You'd be disappointed if you didn't get Weissman and his two brothers turning up.
And then finally, a great episode of Frasier, Miracle on 3rd or 4th Street, that features, and of course, Frasier always featured great guests as callers to Frasier's show, but boy, some of the best ever on this episode, including Mel Brooks, Rosemary Clooney, and Ben Stiller.
It's from 1993, so this is really early. It started in the fall of that year. Cheers went off the air in the spring, so this is like right after that. They're still figuring out their way, although they really had the characters right away. And I would say that later, Frasier becomes so broad as a show that it's not that crisp, intelligent wordplay. It's something else entirely. And someone might think, well, Frasier's Frasier, but now that I've said that, when you watch like season 8 later or whatever it is, you'd be like, he's right. This is a completely different show. These are completely different characters. But this was early on, and a lot of the show is driven by the calls that come in at the radio station, because Frasier has been hoodwinked by Bulldog and he's there with Roz. And it's really depressing, isn't it? Like, it's funny depressing, but the calls are, they're funny. Like, let's come up with the most sort of upsetting Christmas-related calls without going too far that we can come up with. So one, for yucks, is this person sharing this story when they were a kid and they get a puppy. They're going into their parents' room and they're asking, why won't the puppy wake up? I mean, it's that kind of, it's very Black Christmas humor. Like, if you like that film, you'd be like, oh, Frasier's doing Black Christmas. And Frasier himself ends up, after the show, Roz leaves and Frasier's like all grungy and disgusting. And he ends up at this diner and he left his wallet back at the station. And what you get then is this real Holiday Affair, Robert Mitchum, right, type of quiet, lived-in Christmas moment where these guys who don't have a lot of money themselves and are just sort of treating themselves to this one kind of night out end up taking care of Frasier.
Yeah, it's a great episode. Love it. Good stuff there, as always. And you can find those right on YouTube. That's where I watched them over the last couple of days. And again, check out Jazz Times for Colin's great piece on Art Tatum. And it's still not too late for the perfect holiday gift for the reader that you love. Get him a copy of Meathead Say the Realest Things, a short satirical novel of the last bro. You'll be glad you did. It'll make you a better person and you make those people you buy for even better. And we can all use that. Colin, we thank you as always, and we'll do it again next Tuesday.
Okay, sounds good, sir.
Colin Fleming with us on Dan Out.